This is the Fleming Foundation Summer Symposium 2020. Homer, his age, and his legacy. With a lecture by Dr. Thomas Fleming entitled, Homer and the Barbarians.
In 334 BC, Alexander the Great, at the head of an army assembled by his father, Philip II of Macedon, set off to conquer the East. Greeks justified the invasion of the Persian Empire as retribution on the Persians for their attempts to subjugate the Greeks a century and a half earlier. When he crossed the Hellespont, the young Alexander had in his luggage a copy of the Iliad given to him by his tutor, Aristotle. According to a philosopher who accompanied the expedition, Alexander was, quote, naturally a great lover of all kinds of learning and reading. He constantly laid Homer's Iliads, according to the copy corrected by Aristotle, which he called the casket copy because he carried around in a special, beautiful coffer. And he put this with his dagger under the pillow, declaring that he esteemed it a perfect portable knowledge of all military virtue and knowledge. And by the way, if anybody wants to ask about this later, I mean, he actually used Homeric geography in a variety of ways, including selecting the site of Alexandria. Aristotle is said to have advised the Macedonian king to treat the barbarians as slaves and the Greeks as free men. Of course, this is the difference between barbarians and Greeks, slaves and free men. There's a saying that among the Greeks, all the citizens were free, but among the Persians, only the great king was free, and everyone else was his slave. This is what the Persians say. In our time, this advice, whether it's an authentic record or not, has been condemned as racist bigotry, typical of Western man who is so afflicted by his sense of inferiority that he takes refuge in false claims about the superiority of his own Western civilization. Unfortunately, the Macedonian king preferred to be treated as a god, and therefore he could not suffer anyone to be free. This was a temporary episode, however, in Greek history. Alexander destroyed the great city of Thebes for standing up to him, but he spared the house of the poet Pindar. The Persians say Alexander looted and destroyed their temples, but we have little reliable evidence for that patriotic claim. I worked at a hotel once in the kitchen and had an Iranian friend, and he gave me the Persian version of the wars. He said it was just a mere frontier skirmish without any long-term results. The Persians still ruled the world. But when I asked him about Alexander, he declared him a criminal like Hitler. I took that to mean Alexander won. We simply don't know, apart from the burning of Persepolis, how many acts of wanton destruction of religious monuments Alexander committed. We do know that the Greeks felt very strongly about Xerxes' destruction of the temples on the Athenian Acropolis and of many other temples wherever the Persian armies went. Iconoclasm, as the Greeks knew, was a war against both human beings and against their gods. After the war, the Greek allies adopted a resolution not to rebuild the monuments that had been destroyed in order to preserve the memory of the Persians' desecration. Fortunately for us, the Athenians changed their mind and built, of course, the beautiful temples on the Acropolis. In the course of their terrible wars, Greeks and Romans sacked and ruined many cities, looted and destroyed temples. But the deliberate defacement and destruction of historic and religious monuments and buildings were uncommon events associated with the damnatio memoriae. In other words, you destroy the monuments of somebody that you curse and say he never existed. So if you destroy a Confederate monument, you destroy a monument of Robert E. Lee or George Washington, it's because you are cursing him, his people, and his memory. Now, in Egypt, the references to the accursed pharaoh Akhenaten, who attempted to replace all Egyptian divinities with the